Thank you, Brother Steve. Now, as we said before, brothers and sisters and young people, friends, as we begin our second class, we're going to be looking at a figure that is going to overlap what we've previously covered, but we're going to try and bring out some of its distinctiveness. Some of its distinctiveness. Thinking of the ecclesia first as a tabernacle or tent, then thinking of the ecclesia as a temple. Perhaps we've never really explored those two images together. Of course they overlap. But there is a tabernacle and there is a temple. And in the New Testament, there are lessons drawn from both of these at different times, almost as if they're in isolation from one another, although we know they, of course, touch base with each other. In our prospectus for this class, just a little overview, so you see where we're going. Some introductory observations, and then we're going to focus in on the tabernacle and look at it as a figure, first from the Old Testament, under about four headings. Then we're going to look at the tabernacle as a figure of the ecclesia in the New Testament. Then, God willing, we'll take a look before lunch at the concept of the temple from Old and New Testament. And it's the concept we want to get. We're just going to go to some key passages that you can look at later on once you see where they are, and then draw some of the basic lessons that seem to be derived from thinking about ourselves as members of these two structures, a tent or a tabernacle versus a temple. Let's begin once again by going to the book of Hebrews. Even though this is the New Testament, it is speaking of the Old to start with. So our order is to look at the Old Testament first, and we're going to do that by getting a comment about the Old experience from the New. And we touched on this last night with the young people as we were dealing with the promises and peers. And we've already touched base with this once before this morning. Let's just review, though. And now we're going to focus in on one particular word that we haven't emphasized so much before. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whether he went. Now, you remember that passage in Isaiah in the first class a few moments ago. Abraham and Sarah, our mom and our dad spiritually, and we are hewn or we are quarried from the same rock. And in that context of Isaiah 51, it said, "You that follow after righteousness." And we said that's what binds us together as an Abrahamic family, with that stress. What binds us together as an Abrahamic family is that we are striving for righteousness, and it's based on faith as opposed to works, first and foremost. So here it is. By faith, that's Abraham's righteousness. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, went out, not knowing whether he went. Verse 9, though, coming closer, by faith he sojourned in the land of promise. Now, last night with the young people, we talked about the promises. Not yet realized, but the promises. And what were they in the Bible and how that affects the way we think and behave. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country. Wait a minute, this is the land of promise? This was Abraham's land. Abraham was only promised that land. And when he went to bury his wife, he had to buy a piece of real estate in order to bury his wife, Sarah. He didn't own it when he died. By faith, then, he sojourned in the land of promise as, here's the figure, as in a strange country, dwelling in tents or tabernacles, with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Come over to verse 13. Again, we stressed this last night. These all died in faith, not having received the promises. But having seen them afar off, they were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Now, just before we read the next few verses, do you see the associations? The concept of living the life of a stranger, the concept of living the life of a pilgrim, that lifestyle, it's not to say that we all have to dwell in tents, but the concept, the way of thinking, the lifestyle of a stranger and a pilgrim is tied to the life of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They are kind of the Old Testament example of tent dwellers. And as tent dwellers, the figure spoke to the idea of being a pilgrim and a stranger. It spoke to that, the tent dweller. Verse 14, they that say such things, if you say you're a pilgrim, if you say that you're a stranger, well, you declare plainly that you seek a country. You seek a country. Verse 16, but now they desire a better country, like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did. That is, a heavenly. Wherefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. So the tent or the tabernacle is connected to the life of the pilgrim. The city, however, seems to take on a different concept. If you're a pilgrim and a sojourner, you live in a tent. When the journey's done and you're no longer searching and seeking for another country, but the country finally comes and you finally get to that right country, then you're part of a city, not a tent. You see, the end of the journey for a pilgrim is to come to a city. There's a transition in the figures. You're a tent dweller while you're a pilgrim and a sojourner. And that's while you're journeying. But when you're at the end of the journey, you come to a city. You know what? That connects with what we read in Galatians. Jerusalem is the mother of us all. Ah, Jerusalem's a city, a spiritual symbol of the coming of the kingdom and the coming of Christ, a spiritual symbol of the body, the whole ecclesia of Christ, when it's finally grouped together. So there's a sense in which we're striving and looking for a city. When we get there, it's a different concept, figuratively in the Bible. In fact, now you open this up, do you see the difference? A tabernacle like God had built in the wilderness when the people of Israel journeyed through the 40 years of the wilderness experience. God dwelt and he had built a tabernacle or a tent. And day by day, all of those who lived in tents in the wilderness with Moses and Joshua and Caleb got up and moved on when the cloud moved. Sometimes they stayed for a few weeks, might have been a day sometimes, might have been months at times. But they were constantly on the go. What were they doing? They were seeking a country. What country? Well, they were going to be brought into Israel under Joshua eventually. And they would visit that land. And eventually they would build towns and they would build a city called Zion, called Jerusalem. Well, that waited until the time of David. But eventually they did build a capital city. And they did establish it as the city of David. And he did finally put a throne there. And there was finally a temple built there, not a tent. So in the position of a tabernacle, it's impermanent. When you get to a temple, it's permanent. And in the Bible, when we get to the temple period of the Bible, we move to a different way of looking at the saints in their daily lives and how they look at themselves. Not totally different. It overlaps. But there's a difference in the shift. From tent dwellers, people tied to a tabernacle as the place of worship, as opposed to being temple dwellers, part of a temple service that is situated in a city and that has a priesthood. Let's just explore this a little further. We understand then as we move, just taking a look at our perspective, as we move through the Old Testament, exploring this concept in order, and it's the divine order, it's the real order. We're going to shift from this kind of lifestyle, this kind of way of thinking, which lasts right up until Christ returns. We're going to also shift from that way of looking at worship, And that way is being part of a body of worshipers to something much more permanent called not a tent, but a temple, which is just much more permanent. Much more permanent. It's not something we've yet realized, but it is something to which we're striving. Now, since we're in Hebrews, would you back up, please, to Hebrews chapter 8. We're going to look at two passages in the book of Hebrews that use both of these figures. The figures that we're talking about, the tabernacle and the temple. So, first passage is Hebrews chapter 8. And so I don't do too much shifting around here for the cameraman. I'm going to stay by this, and you're reading it in your Bible, and we're going to take a look at it from the overhead as well. Hebrews 8, verses 1 and 2. For we have such a high priest, present tense. This is after the death of Jesus. Hebrews is one of the last epistles to be written before 70 AD. So it's very late. We have such an high priest, says Paul. And then he says, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle or the true tent, which the Lord pitched and not man. Now there you have it in the New Testament. We know where it is in the Old Testament. We've just looked at it. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob dwelt in tents or tabernacles. We know from Sunday school experience about the children of Israel being in the wilderness and building a tabernacle. Okay, we know that. But in the New Testament, are we talked about just as a temple? No, we're not. In the New Testament, we're also talked about as being connected to a tabernacle or a tent. And he looks at Jesus as a tent which he pitched. How did he ever pitch Jesus as a tent? Well, he dwelt in the tent of the Old Testament. His presence was in the tabernacle in the wilderness, his presence. He filled the tabernacle when it was all set up and all the furniture was laid out. God filled the tabernacle and the cloud hovered over the tabernacle. Well, Jesus is God's true tent, true dwelling place. And therefore, in a sense, God looked at Jesus as his son in whom he dwelt fully, as being a tent which God pitched like the tabernacle, and God dwelt in Christ, filled Christ. He had the Spirit without measure, he says in John's Gospel. Had the Spirit without measure. He was the walking embodiment of God's character in his mind, Jesus was. He was the Word made flesh. And God says in John's Gospel, he tabernacled with men through Christ. So yes, that's important, but you know, it's being said in the New Testament. Long after Israel were Bedouins. At the time here, in the book of Hebrews, most of Israel are not Bedouins. They're town dwellers, most of them. But they're still to think of Jesus that way, and they're connected to that themselves. Now, 2 Corinthians chapter 6. There's another one in Hebrews, but we'll use this one next. It's complementary, says the same thing, very, very deliberately. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16. Now the imagery shifts to that of a temple. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 16. In part, the verse says, for ye are the temple of the living God. You remember Peter talking about Jesus being a living stone? You remember in the last class at the end, we're talked about as living stones? And all the imagery of the stones that we talked about in the last class, we as part of a divine family, a divine house, the Hebrew word to build, son, daughter, house, home, family, all connected. Stones don't make up a tent. Stones make up a building that's permanent. We are, says Peter, stones, living stones. When he moves into that kind of imagery, the apostle is being inspired to get the disciples to think about themselves, when they think of themselves as stones, as being temple-like. It is a figure of permanence. It's a figure that's fixed. to dwell in a tent. Well, by definition, it's something you pick up and fold down and you move along with. It's a Bedouin lifestyle. But the temple figure is more permanent. And the concept of us being stones, that's a more permanent figure. It doesn't go with tent, it goes with temple. Now, how can we be both? Well, the ecclesia is pictured, beyond any shadow of a doubt, both ways. A tabernacle and a temple. And we're talked about that way as you see those two passages simultaneously. Now, and also, there's a sense in which one of those two, especially, reaches down to something future, especially, where, when Christ returns, the temple figure is the dominant figure, to picture the idea of the ecclesia. When Christ returns and sets up his kingdom on the earth, the ecclesia then is almost entirely in Scripture talked about as part of a city which has foundations, as New Jerusalem, which comes down from heaven in the book of Revelation, as a city, symbol of a community. It is a symbol of something permanent because then Christ is on the earth. And Christ will be the king and he will be the ruler, and there'll be no longer a sojourning. In a sense, we've come to the end of our journey and the world itself. The one actually is tied, the temple, intimately to a vision of the future, although there's a sense in which now, of course, we are to live as though we are living stones. But we're not yet put together. It speaks of something yet future. And it speaks especially of something that is related to the promises of David, young people, as we talked about last night. Something to do with the temple, the city of Jerusalem, a land of promise. A place where there'll be a temple of the future age, where the world will come to worship, from which the gospel will go out to all the world. That's all related to the temple picture tied to permanence, as opposed to the tabernacle that speaks for a lifestyle today where we are detached from this order of things and live accordingly. Now, just go back to Genesis again. Would you go now to Genesis chapter 14? Genesis chapter 14. While Abraham was a tent dweller, and Abraham never did see a temple, Solomon saw it. David only saw the blueprints. But while Abraham was still a tent dweller, in Genesis 14, he has an encounter with a man who is connected to a city called Sodom. Abraham, the tent dweller, and the king of Sodom, a city dweller. And there was a difference between those two at that time. I want you to notice something that comes right out of Abraham's perspective as a tent dweller and someone who was detached from the world around him because he was just passing through at that time. Genesis chapter 14. After Abram has rescued Lot, he deals with the king of Sodom, who was one of the kings that had Lot in custody, because the king of Sodom had made an alliance with some of the other local kings of the towns and of the cities. And they formed an alliance, they formed an army, and Abraham had to finally deal with them. And then he had to dig out Lot, his relative. So, we come to this encounter between Abraham and Sodom. Verse 21. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, give me the persons and take the goods to thyself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up my hand unto Yahweh, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread, even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou should say, I've made Abram rich, save only that which the young men have eaten and the portion of the men which went with me. A city dweller, Sodom. A tent dweller, Abram. This is the finale of a major event in the book of Genesis. And Abram's purpose was to retrieve Lot. And having done all that, these two men are now talking. And Sodom, the king of Sodom, quite generously says, Abram, take it for nothing. No, says Abram, I will not take it for nothing. I will not be in debt to you. I will not even take a thread from your clothing. I will not even take a shoe latchet from your shoe gratis. No, I won't, says Abram. I'll pay you what I owe you. I will not be in debt to you. The king of Sodom and Abram, the tent dweller. You see the contrast. This tent dweller understood in his lifestyle, Abram, that he was passing through and he wasn't going to even express an indebtedness to the king of Sodom. He was not going to be in debt to the world. He wasn't going to owe the king of Sodom anything. That's the extent to which, though he was polite and respectful to this king of Sodom, Abraham went that way, the king of Sodom went that way. And Abram remained detached from any ties whatsoever, down to a thread or a shoelace. Now you might think that's extreme, but Abram understood at this time that as the life of a city dweller, looking for a city which had foundations related to the God called Yahweh, the God of Israel, he was not going to get entangled with the world. You see that, young people? He wasn't going to get entangled with the world. Its entertainment systems, its way of spending time, its way of spending money, the television programs, the videos, all the junk that comes from the world, and worldly friends, the king of Sodom. This man, Abram, was a man of some means. He owed a lot of cattle. He had a lot of servants. This was not some boy from the backwoods. Abram was a man of some means, considerably. He raised an army of several hundred servants to meet the king of Sodom. He was a man of wealth. He was respected. But he would not tie himself into the world or worldly friends. He kept himself detached. Interesting. That's part of being a tent dweller. That's part of being detached from the world's goods in that sense. Now, we come back to our little prospectus here for this class. As a tabernacle, there are some other lessons we want to just draw from before we move to the idea of us being part of a temple. Would you come then, please, to Exodus chapter 25. Exodus chapter 25. Part of being connected to the tabernacle. In this case, the tabernacle in the wilderness. Here's a principle. Exodus 25. It's a tabernacle principle. Here, Exodus 25, come down to verse 40. As the tabernacle is being built, if you look at the title of your page, if you have a Bible page with titles, you'll see it's got something to do with Moses commanding about the tabernacle and parts of the tabernacle. Verse 40 of Exodus 25. God says to Moses, and look that thou make them after the pattern which was showed thee in the mount. Tabernacle as it was, temporary dwelling as it was, this tabernacle was to be built according to a divine pattern showed to you, Moses, in the mount. One of the tabernacle principles of the tabernacle in the wilderness was when it was built, Moses and Joshua didn't just sort of think up the measurements. The ecclesia, the symbol of the ecclesia, the tabernacle, was to be put together by divine principles and by God's command. How they worked as brothers and sisters, the roles of the brothers, the roles of the sisters, how they dressed, how they behaved, how they worked together as a team, was by the pattern that God had laid down. as a tabernacle, even though it was impermanent. And even though that tabernacle was folded down and then pitched up and folded down and pitched up for 40 years, it was written and made, put together by a pattern. It was by divine principles that the ecclesia was to run by. You know, that's a practical lesson. Number one, the tabernacle was made by divine command and it operated according to divine principles. Now, Exodus chapter 25, if you go back a chapter, Exodus 25, here's our second point. You might be following this. I'm right here. Okay? Bullet number two. Exodus chapter 25, verse 31. Here's another principle of the tabernacle. Verse 31, Exodus 25, thou shalt make a candlestick of pure gold of beaten work. Shall the candlestick be made? His shaft and his branches, his bowls and his knops, and his flowers shall be of the same. You won't tack on a separate piece of gold to make the last branch. The last three or four branches, as what the whole of the lampstand, are to be made of the same beaten piece of metal, so that it's all of the same. You see? Sameness. Sameness. Verse 36, their knops and their branches shall be of the same, and it shall be one beaten work of pure gold. Wow, look at that word one. One beaten work. God's not wanting two pieces of gold leaf that's kind of hammered out together. He wants one gold leaf. He wants one construction. It'll be of the same piece of metal. So you won't get bits and pieces sort of joined together. And they could do this. Metallurgists could do it. But no, it was to be of one plate. All together, oneness, sameness. Now just watch what else is said here. In Exodus chapter 28. Slip over there. In the same neighborhood. Exodus chapter 28. Exodus chapter 28. And we come down to verse 31 and 32. Now this is dealing with the priest's clothing. Part of the priest's clothing was the ephod, which carried the 12 stones of the breastplate. Now verse 31, in the priest's clothing, thou shalt make the robe of the ephod all of blue, and there shall be an hole in the top of it in the midst thereof, and it shall have a binding of woven work round about the whole of it, as it were the whole of a harbingen, that it be not rent. You will make the priest's clothing in such a way that it will never be ripped. The priest's clothing must remain as one, and it's going to be made and fabricated in such a way that it will prevent rips. It will stand as one. Isn't that interesting? The tabernacle metal or the fabric of the priest's clothing. The concept is of one. Now slip over to Exodus 37. As another case in point of the same lesson. It's all over as a principle in the tabernacle. The principle of oneness. The principle of unity. In everything that was made as part of this tent. Exodus 37 and verse 7. And he made two cherubims of gold, beaten out of one piece, made he them on the two ends of the mercy seat. It had to be made again of one beaten work. So there's the concept of oneness. All together, built in. And you know, these materials that were contributed were not just contributed by brethren. Come over to Exodus while we're here. Exodus 35. Exodus 35. The materials for this tabernacle were contributed by those who had a willing heart. Verse 5 of Exodus 35. Take ye from among you an offering unto the Lord, Whosoever is of a willing heart, whosoever, male or female, young or old, that is of a willing heart, let him bring it, an offering of the Lord, gold and silver and brass and blue and purple and scarlet and so on. The contributions were from everybody. Now in this chapter, go down to verse 25. And verse 25, all the women that were wise-hearted did spin with their hands and brought that which they had spun, both of blue and of purple, of scarlet and of fine linen. And all the women whose hearts stirred them up in wisdom spun goat's hair. God's building is put together by males and females. The tabernacle, as impermanent as it was constructed by a principle of oneness. And that oneness dovetailed with the fact that all the contributors came from all parts of the people. It wasn't just the brethren making up this tabernacle, it was the sisters too. It was meant to be a symbol of them. A symbol of oneness, but a symbol of joint cooperation, of joint willingness together. So really a wonderful principle when you see that emerging. Now let's just look in Exodus 31. Back up. Exodus chapter 31. Exodus chapter 31. And look closely now at verse 10. The clothes are described in a very special way. That's the clothes of the priests. Verse 10 of Exodus 31. And the clothes of service and the holy garments for Aaron the priest and the garments of his son to minister in the priest's office. Did you see what's said in verse 9? The clothing the priests wore is described as cloths or clothes of service. Clothes of service. Now, as you look step by step at the tabernacle and how it was put together, it was to be by divine principles. Contributors, young and old, male and female. Service was to be something that was fundamental. Service is described by the example of the priest's clothes as being clothes of service. If you're going to be working in this tabernacle as priests, you will put on clothes of service. Do you see what the ecclesia is all about, therefore? Do you see young people in the CYC as we work together and support the CYC young people's activities? One of the reasons we're there is to serve one another. And when people in Israel served in the tabernacle, they wore clothes that were called clothes of service. Because that's what it's partly all about. It's about serving God. It's also about serving one another, by which we serve God. And God stressed the principle of service by describing the clothes of the priest as clothing of service. And when Jesus was in the upper room, he took off his regular clothes. And he took a towel, the towel or the apron that he took and put around his waist in the upper room, by which he kneeled down and washed the feet of his disciples, was a slave's apron. It was not just any old piece of cloth. It was a slave's apron, a slave's towel, as it's used in the original Greek. He wore at that time the service clothing. The clothing that stood for that of a lowly slave, a household slave, as he went from one pair of feet to the other and washed them in a basin of water in the upper room. He girded himself with a slave's towel, clothing of service. It's really powerful then, as you look at the lessons of the tabernacle, what emerges as lessons for us as an ecclesia. Do we serve one another in that spirit? Do we strive for the principles that God has laid down in our ecclesial life, in our homes? Or do we decide that we're going to make up our own rules, our own guidelines? Do we see ourselves as joint contributors with a willing heart, male and female, part of the whole tabernacle service? And do we strive for the kind of oneness that's being stressed here as one of the principles of the tabernacle? Just before we leave the tabernacle, you turn to Exodus chapter 36. There's a beautiful little point here, tucked away. Exodus chapter 36. It's, we could call it a tabernacle principle, even though it was also true in a certain way in the temple. Okay, I want you to come to Exodus chapter 36. And now we're looking at the construction materials of the tabernacle. We're going to come down to verse 22 of Exodus 36. Exodus 22. One board, that's one of the boards that held up the tabernacle or the tent. One board had two tenons, equally distant from one another. Thus did he make all the boards of the tabernacle. Now, I've got a diagram here, which comes from the internet, but it's quite valid. And it's this. It shows that these tenons were in fact joiners from board to board to board to board. This is not a picture of a railway track. It's a picture of the tabernacle as it's perceived by this artist. And the boards are internally locked together by tenons, and outside, and this is valid from Exodus, outside a bar ran along, and there were three of them. One, two, three. This diagram shows it more clearly, which we're now pointing to from this side. One, two, three bars, and there were these hoops or circles of brass. So the boards were interlocked. We would say tongue and groove, perhaps, if we were carpenters today. There was an interlocking among the boards. And outside, the rigidity was ensured by these three bars that in turn were, as it were, forced into the boards by these brass hoops. All of which says something. It was all compact together. And when you take a look at the Hebrew words, look what you discover. The word for tenons in the King James in Exodus 36:22 is in fact Strong's number 3027. And it's the Hebrew word for hands. The Hebrew word for hands. The boards were joined together by hands. It was a symbol of being compact, a symbol of unity, a symbol of board to board, board to board, parts of the tabernacle coming together by hand in hand, hand in hand. They were joined by hands. Not only that, but the same Hebrew word for tenons, 3027, is used in Leviticus for the word fellowship. It's translated fellowship. Now, we're not going to go there, but when you come to Exodus 28, verse 7, which is dealing, in fact, with some of the garments of the priest. There's another Hebrew word, 2266, that talks about the garments being joined. And that word joined, speaking of the garments of the priest, is also translated in the Psalms as fellowship. Two different Hebrew words, one for tenons, one's for joined. One's meaning hands, but the other one is translated fellowship. In every respect, even beyond the level of the curtains, as you looked at the boards, as they were joined together, interlocked, and as you looked at how they were given rigidity and strength, they're pictured as symbols of fellowship. They're pictured as being hand in hand, part of this impermanent building, but nevertheless filled with permanent principles in that sense. So then, when we move on to the temple, as a symbol, we're going to have overlapping principles, for sure. Just turn to the book of Ephesians, where we were earlier. We're going to have overlapping principles, but this won't be very hard now, by way of conclusion, to execute, because as a temple, we have something very permanent, which we don't have in the real sense right now. We're part of the building that's being put together. We are living stones. We are not yet assembled together in the fullest sense. But see in Ephesians 2 how this language of the temple is applied to us in a sense now as a temple that's in building. Something much more permanent. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 19. Now therefore, ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building, now this is more permanent, in whom all the building fitly framed together. Well, we saw how that was true in the tabernacle, but even more so in what it now says. In whom all the building fitly framed, interlocked together, groweth unto a holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for a habitation of God through the Spirit. There you have it. Ephesians is talking about us growing, developing. And we're growing and developing to become a habitation of God, a dwelling of God through the Spirit. God, through his word, is to dwell in each one of us. God is to dwell in the ecclesia as he dwelt in the tabernacle and as he dwelt among the Israelites in their camp. His Spirit, through his word and through the work of the angels, are to be in the ecclesia now. And as we saw with the young people last night, that hope must be in us. That word as a cleansing agent must be in my heart and in my mind. In that sense, the Spirit is to be in us now, developing us into new people. In the ecclesia now, developing it into a temple to be. It groweth, but it's not yet there, into a temple of the Lord. And that will be something permanent. Turn now then to Revelation as we bring this to a conclusion. Overlapping as the principles are from tabernacle to temple, there are some uniquenesses about the tabernacle, and there are some uniquenesses about the imagery of the temple. Something we are not yet, but in prospect hope to be. So Revelation chapter 21. Remember what Paul said in Hebrews, that we as sojourners, as tent dwellers, are looking for a city which has foundations? Well, look at Revelation 21. We come back to the imagery of a city, which is tied to the idea of a temple. Verse 1 of Revelation 21. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city. This is future. I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them. They shall be his people. God himself shall be with them and be their God. There's the tabernacle, still being sustained as a picture of the coming ecclesia, although here it is referring to a city, the more permanent idea. But now come to verse 21 and verse 22 and 3. Chapter 21, verses 21 to 23. In this vision, John says, and the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Every several gate was of one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, as it were transparent glass. And I saw no temple therein, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. And the city had no need of sun, neither of moon, to shine in it. For the glory of God did lighten it, and the lamp is the light thereof. So what have we seen by way of conclusion? What we've seen, as we finish off our picture in the second class of the ecclesia being both a tabernacle and a temple, is that both of those two figures interlock. But there are some uniquenesses about the tabernacle concept, as it is impermanent. And even though some of those principles, of course, of unity and of service carry over into the temple and its service, the temple speaks especially for the saints of something yet future, although we're being part of it in its makeup now. And the temple speaks especially of a dwelling place for God connected to the new city that will come down with Christ's return from heaven and make permanent a dwelling place for God as he dwells in the world through his community, through his ecclesia. All of which, of course, then, by way of conclusion, is a journey. And you know, the words said by Deborah to our friend Barak are very pertinent as we close our morning classes. We are journeying with the ecclesia of God, young people and brothers and sisters. We are on a journey. There's a sense now that we are strangers and pilgrims in this world as a tabernacle. But we are looking for something that has a destination. And you know, these words in Judges chapter 4, verse 9, from the woman Deborah to Barak the warrior are pertinent. And she, Deborah, said, I will surely go with thee to Barak, the soldier. Notwithstanding, says Deborah, the journey that thou takest shall not be for thine honor. And as pilgrims journeying, as temple dwellers, as people seeking a temple and a city to be, on a journey, we're just passing through. But the journey is not for our honor. It is to give honor to Yahweh, our God in heaven. Thank you.